Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Soze!
No, that's Matthew Soze.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever, yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Soze.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soce. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Ladies and gentlemen, every now and then, film sociology becomes stage sociology because I like promoting plays whenever possible. And anytime there is a play that has a cinematic touch, homage, treatment, whatever, we try to have that in studio. And joining me in studio is director Darren Murrell, who is going to provide such stuff. Actually, it's already up and running, literally. He is directing the comedy Hold On To Your Butts. It is a staged version of Jurassic Park. So, how you doing?
Hi, Matthew. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you here, Darren. So, you know what? Normally, I would go through what's new in theaters and DVD. Guess what? Captain Marvel opened last week.
Yes,
so,
it's
still out there. I still am for the idea of being rescued by Brie Larson and having a cat possibly get a spin-off film of its own. So
absolutely.
We will get there. But I want to start with, so how did you get involved with Hold On To Your Butts, which we don't get to say enough here at NPR?
Well, sure. It's okay to say butts.
So far.
Okay, good.
It is in the end. We just can't say it on Sundays.
Of course not.
Right.
I've been a big fan of this company in New York called Recent Cutbacks that has a local connection. There's a fellow called Nick Abeal.
My wife has worked and I believe directed Mr. Abeal in his younger days.
Yes, so he's gone on to New York and has gathered a group of friends together as a company there called Recent Cutbacks, and they produce these pop culture parodies, live, shot-for-shot recreations of sort of iconic pop culture, iconic movies. Their first one, and they're probably their biggest hit, is Hold On To Your Butts, which does that treatment with Jurassic Park. They had brought the show to the Indy Fringe Festival 2 years previously, and I saw it with my kids and loved it. They were crazy for it. And I then went on to sort of look at some of Recent Cutbacks' other properties. So recently, Pauline from the Indie Fringe has been working with the Central Indiana Community Foundation to shore up and breathe new life and rebrand what used to be the Theater on the Square venue.
Yes.
On Mass Ave is now the District. And as part of that rebranding, she wanted to do something unique and different in the cabaret space there at the District. Something that would appeal not only to regular theater goers, but to folks who might not otherwise think to walk in and spend two and a half hours at a play or a musical, but might like a 1 hour funny, pop culture-laden distraction in the midst of their evening on Mass Ave.
What's interesting is, especially because it is the old Theater on the Square space, but you are tapping into a piece of theater history that I don't think gets talked about enough. So the fact, and as I think I say on some other show on Saturday night, something old and something new. But in the old Theater on the Square days, Ron Spencer, hi Ron, I know you're in Mexico listening.
Yes.
But Ron would do the film noir series, where
yes.
he would take classic movies and stage them in a unsubtle, kind of over the top aspect right. of that, and it's very, very, it was very, very fun to watch. And sometime off air, I'll tell the story of how that stopped, but I'm not going to do that here. But I mean, but it was also an excuse for him to play Tallulah Bankhead in Lifeboat, the little girl in The Bad Seed, to play Betty Davis in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So anyway, I mean, that's different. But the fact is, doing parodies. Valentines of old movies on stage, and in this case, you know, Dinosaurs Run Amok.
Yes, and it was an established product, which appealed to me. It wasn't something we were making up from scratch.
And I would say you don't there are no assassins from Universal Pictures or Mr. Spielberg or Mr. Crichton coming after.
Exactly. This has all been vetted in New York City before it ever made its way to the streets of Indianapolis. So that was important to us as
sure.
well. And myself, I've always been a big fan of, obviously I'm a fan of theater, but I'm also a big fan of sketch comedy. I spent a good deal of my youth in Chicago in the 90s. And, you know, you can't swing a cat without hitting an improv troupe.
There is, my wife just got done directing Women Playing Hamlet.
Oh.
And the running bit in that everybody has an MFA.
Yeah.
So, yeah, everybody has an improv troupe in Chicago.
Absolutely. But, obviously, Second City is the mother of them all.
Right.
And I spent countless nights at Second City, both in the ETC room and in the main stage room, and saw, I mean, some of the great people, and some of them I got to know because I was of an age of as them as well, and also working in the industry. So, like Steve Carell, for instance, I actually knew his then girlfriend, now wife, Nancy, pretty well through the Human Race Theater.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, ever since then, and even before then, I mean, going back to my young days, watching Saturday Night Live was always one of the great joys of my childhood. My parents allowed me to watch Saturday Night Live from its inception. I was watching it in 1975.
As was I. So, yeah, that was like the first, and part of it was Saturday because, you know, the only thing you really had to commit to on Sunday was church and homework. So,
absolutely. And, I'm not an athlete. I wasn't an athletic child.
No tournaments across the state
no,
on a Sunday morning.
No. And pretty much my Saturdays and Sundays were spent either at the movies.
That's
or
not bad.
In front of the TV, watching either family classics on Sunday afternoons, or on Saturdays it was Abbott and Costello and
yep.
And the Hope Crosby movies and the Three Stooges and on and on. I mean that was my theatrical education.
Where'd you grow up?
Just east of Muncie. Selma, Indiana.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So I grew up in Flint, and ours was of course, here at Film Sociology, we are the pro horror show hosts. I'm currently wearing the Sammy Terry shirt because
yes,
it's
are.
Part of the NPR uniform. But I know Sammy, of course, was huge down here.
Yes.
That was yours.
Absolutely.
I had Sir Graves Gasley out of Channel 2 in Detroit.
Yes.
And then there was a brief period in the early 80s. Where we had Count Scary on Channel 4, and he didn't do anything regular. He did like every few months or every quarter he would do something. He was the first one where he and his lackey talked over a movie. It was Dracula versus Frankenstein. So this is way before Mr. Sun's Theater.
Right.
Svengoolie, of course, is based out of Chicago. You can
yep.
still see him Saturday nights at 8 on MeTV. Yeah, I'm plugging MeTV on NPR. So he was briefly syndicated for a while. Then there was Elvira.
Right.
Enough said. And then Channel 2. The other thing I found out later with Sir Graves Gasley, it was after he died, but he lived in Cleveland, and he would drive to Detroit twice a month to film those spots, those shows. And anyway, so after Elvira, late, I think it was like 1 in the morning, there was a group out of Chicago that aired on Detroit television called Big Chuck and Little John. Anyway, great time-wasting for a young lad without a driver's license.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the Saturday Night Live really started my love of sketch comedy, and I knew that a lot of those people had come from Second City, so when I got to Chicago, you know, it was like a
beacon. It's like the minor league, sort of.
Absolutely. So this show and what I was seeing recent cutbacks doing with these parodies felt very much like long-form sketch comedy. The shows are less than an hour long, so it's not quite taking a Saturday Night Live sketch and stretching it out into a full two-hour movie.
There's snarky stuff about the movies of SNL sketches.
Exactly. So this cuts that in half.
Thank God.
So you still get a good length. It's longer than a seven-minute sketch, but... it also, like you say, pays homage to these iconic films.
I wonder, because I was doing a little, and I read on the website, it says part spoof, part parody. What's the percentage on that?
Yeah, I'm going to say, the biggest element that can't be compared one-to-one with the film is the fact that almost all of the props are mimed, and the setting is all imagined, and the environment for the audience is created, the cinematic environment is really created by a Foley artist. So there's a sound person sitting at a table, like Fred Newman, and has...
Oh, very good, thank you. Long-time listener.
Thank you. First-time caller. But Olivia Shopperjohn is her name, and she has a whole array of toys and sound makers in front of her, many of them just household objects that she uses to create sounds that seem like the sounds from the film. And then she also uses her voice,
yes,
as much as anything else to create the sounds and the soundtrack. So obviously,
Mr. Williams' sharpshooters aren't.
Yes, no. So we don't actually use any tracks from the movie at all. There's nothing straight from the film, except for snippets of dialogue.
Okay.
So as we track through the film, and it hits almost every single scene in the movie. Obviously, we're not doing the full scenes.
Right.
They're condensed. But each scene chronologically is represented. And some of the dialogue is a one-for-one match.
Right.
Never for more than a couple of sentences, however. You mentioned MST3K earlier, and in some ways there's a bit of an element of that, because as we're working through the dialogue, the actors and their characters are also commenting on the situation, the dialogue, the scenes as they're going.
And you have two actors.
Two actors play all of the parts.
Everything.
Yes.
How does one divvy that up? Well, obviously, as you said, there's a lot of two people scenes, but how does one divvy it up? I've directed radio plays before, and so are there moments where there's one actor having a scene with themselves?
Absolutely. It happens all the time, and we have several scenes, like the dinner table scene when they first get to the park and they're all sitting around eating and debating the ethics of doing this. There are seven people at that table and two actors playing them. So they will often jump back and forth between characters by physically shifting their bodies.
Always good for the audience.
Maybe putting a pair of glasses on or taking it off. One of the characters, the lawyer, Gennaro, is portrayed by a Senior Wences-style hand puppet with a tie hanging off of the wrist.
Cute.
Yes. But like I say, there's this constant sort of running commentary. Like, for instance, when Hammond, the owner of the park, first shows up in Montana at the dig site to try to recruit Sam Neill's character to come and be a consultant. In the movie, they're in the trailer that Alan Grant is staying in while he's at this dig site, and Sir Richard Attenborough, as Hammond, starts making drinks for the Sam Neill and Laura Dern character in the little kitchen of this trailer as they're talking. So when it gets to that part in our play, the guy who's playing Hammond says, "Oh, no, please let me get this for you. I know my way around a tiny trailer kitchen."
Oh,
clearly, tiny trailer kitchen is not in the dialogue of the film.
No,
it exists here to comment on this.
So the other thing, first off, full disclosure, I've known Olivia Shepherd-John since she was in her mother's tummy. I went to school with her mom, Tony. We are products of, as I like to call, the Ball State University.
Yeah, chirp, chirp.
Thank you. The other thing I was wondering is, I was going to say, how much loving snark is there? I honestly, I haven't seen Jurassic Park in a while, long time, but like, in the last couple films, it's easy to make fun of Bryce Dallas Howard's footwear.
Right.
So I wondered if there was little digs on Jeff Goldblum, 21st century, things of that nature.
Oh, certainly.
Or little winks or nods to the sequels. Is that able to stab at it?
We never touch the sequels, but there are a couple of, I mean, the Goldblum character is the one that kind of gets the
all
most.
The glory. Yeah.
And, you know, it's the iconic
back,
impression.
So, yeah.
Right. There's obviously the scene where he's got his shirt inexplicably hanging open for no good reason. And that is parodied to the extreme.
Does he lose his mantra? Thank you, longtime Woody Allen fans. Or Death Wish. We won't go there, really.
There's another improvised moment. Of course, his character, his whole running dialogue in the film is about the chaos theory and how, you know, life will find a way because of chaos. And you can't plan on the order of things. And so to demonstrate this chaos theory, at one point in our play, the actor playing him each night improvises some comment about Goldblum's later career to demonstrate chaos. Like one night he said, have you ever enslaved a Norse god and had him fight for your amusement? Chaos! Another time he said, have you ever released a series of jazz albums? Chaos.
So excellent.
There's that there sort of go. Commentary, and there's commentary on the script and the show itself. For instance, at one point, Dr. Grant, they've just come across the sick Triceratops, and Laura Dern's character says, "Oh, I want to stay here with the trike. There's a gas powered Jeep. We'll come back later." And the Alan Grant character in our play responds to her by saying, "Oh yeah, sure. I mean, it's not like we're in a survival situation or anything where we'll be separated, right. You know, by dangerous dinosaurs."
I was also wondering in this. So, without giving away too much, as far as Olivia's job as Foley artist, yeah. I guess I will say what is used for the first big foot stomp.
That's her voice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
She encases the mic with her hands.
Somebody hold a cup of water while it's happening.
That's
something like that. Okay.
Yes,
all right.
The
all
cup
right.
of water see? Scene is completely represented.
See, there you go, folks. This is all happening. So you should check that. And this is running through the end of March.
End of March.
We can't talk ticket prices, but
sure.
Where can people go for tickets and more information?
There's a couple of places actually. IndieFringe.org. The Indie Fringe Theater is managing the district theater as part of a contract with CICF. So they have tickets on their site, indiefringe.org. The district theater on their website, which is indiedistricttheater.org. And then the Laugh Shows Facebook page, that's LAFF Shows. That's our brand for the entire series. We're following up Hold On To Your Butts with two other parodies immediately after that.
And those are?
So Hold On To Your Butts runs through the end of March, and then for the month of April, we're doing The Golden Girls, The Lost Episodes.
Oh, jeez.
So this is a piece.
B. Arthur off air.
The twist here is that it's all done in drag.
Of course.
For the most part. Olivia is playing Sophia, the Estelle Getty little lady role. But other than that, the other three ladies are all played by men. It's pretty vulgar, the script.
No.
It's
yeah.
It is a bit. It kind of takes them to the extreme. But this is a show that's been running for like 10 or 15 years up in Chicago with Hell in a Handbag Productions. They've actually done several sequels. They've got a Valentine's episode and a Halloween episode, and it's...
So if it goes well.
Yes. And then for the month of May, we're doing another recent cutbacks show called Fly, You Fools, which is The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring.
Okay.
gosh. It's
or
still,
perhaps I could have it's, said, it's fly, still, you fools!
It's still ending. sorry, I'm snarky about Lord of the Rings. Okay, so again, you can go online, check that out. You can, and there is, again, we don't talk prices, but there is a package deal with all three
yes.
if you are so inclined. So,
yep. And cool. the shows are Friday and Saturday nights, two shows each night, one at 8 o'clock and
well,
one at 10 o'clock.
One would hope so.
Yeah.
No change from the 10 to the 8?
Well, again, there's always a little bit of improvisation.
Sure.
There's the shows are scripted, but there's enough wiggle room for them to have a little bit of fun.
How was Jurassic Park in your world before you started directing this?
It was a movie that changed my life in some ways. You know, I've always been had always been and still am a devotee of Spielberg's artistry and his craftsmanship, and this was to me his first real horror film. I mean, it really felt like a modern-day monster movie to me.
Yeah, and it was, I mean, it's an expensive, and especially with Universal, it's an expensive science gone wrong picture. Very expensive.
Yeah. But it was the first time in my, you know, mid-life that I had seen a big-budget Hollywood movie done as a full-on monster horror film.
Okay. Very good. I had just graduated from the Ball State University, and I was in my I had also written my first play, so I was wound very tight, and this was the summer I was working summer theater box office and other things, and this was the era where I was reading the novels before seeing the films. By the way, folks, don't do that to yourself. It started with The Firm and the John Grisham, which I read in like a day. I mean, you plow through that book. It's like, and it's written as a screenplay. And then a group of us went to go see it opening weekend. Half of us had read the book. The other half had not. And those of us who had read it after the last hour were completely livid. Just, you know, and it was Tom Cruise running for an hour. And you know, later on I had read articles, and you know, Grisham was not pleased, and he talked to Sidney Pollack, and I'm paraphrasing, but Sidney Pollack basically said, "You got your check, you cashed it, shut up."
Yeah.
And I wound up doing it with, I don't remember the adaptation as much with Jurassic Park, but like Rising Sun and a few others, and I was 20 and out of school. I had time, so don't do that to yourself, folks. I as a young writer, I understood I had to go through that. So hopefully you don't as well. So there's your PSA.
I had read the book prior to seeing the film.
Okay,
and it did not disappoint. It was a different thing to me.
Sure,
the book is so much more sort of technical and
well, I think if Mr. Crichton had directed it, it probably would have been more technical than the visual and old horror. Or at a feel, as you put it.
Yeah. I actually read it on a plane ride to Aruba.
Oh, my gosh. Not on the beach?
No. I think I finished it on the beach. I got through most of it on the plane ride, but it was quite visceral landing on Aruba with that all of that imagery fresh in my head.
So how have the sequels been in your world?
Well,
sorry, because that's low hanging fruit.
Yeah, I mean, I really couldn't stomach the first two sequels. I didn't mind the reboot
or her footwear. Also, low hanging
so
fruit.
Much, but I the storytelling in the reboot I felt was honorable.
Okay. Well, I think also, and I'm sure all of that strengthens your love of the first.
Oh, yes, for sure.
I've told the story before, but I was 7 when the first Star Wars film came out.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Star Wars. Nothing else. There were no episodes. Well, there were episodes, but we didn't know that. But anyway. And it's hard to top that. It's
yeah.
hard to top that point in time as a kid. You're still getting introduced to cinema. And so, obviously, I'm a devotee of the threes, and we still make fun of the third. And then the threes are, the next three are a mixed bag. And then when I think it was Last Jedi, where I looked and I saw guys my age with their kids who were my age when the first one came out. So they were going to have that experience. So, you know, bully for them.
Yeah.
But I think it's also a timing thing. And I think it sounds like Jurassic Park hit you at a peak time, at
absolutely.
A right time. So,
absolutely.
And that's hard to top. And so that's why when 2, 3 reboots, footwear, as I mentioned before, my buddy Andy, who is playing in Young Frankenstein at Civic, you know, despised the last film.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a group, a podcast called The Flophouse. They actually did a show at Earlham, and they discussed Jurassic World. And I wound up watching it because they were going to be there. So anyway, it's all a timing thing sometimes as well.
Right. A little full circle there.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned Young Frankenstein. When I was 7 years old, I accidentally had Young Frankenstein be my first sort of grown-up cinematic experience.
Thank you for saying grown-up and not adult. There's a difference.
Yes. So my mother and grandmother thought they were taking me to see a Herbie the Love Bug sequel. And
took a wrong turn?
We walked into the wrong theater.
Oh, my God.
In a small multiplex. I think there were 3 theaters in this little plaza theater in Muncie.
Right.
And we happened to walk into the wrong one. And it wasn't until he jabs himself in the leg with the scalpel that they realized we were in the wrong place. And I was hooked because I had already by that time grown up watching Sammy Terry and was, you know, knew the name James Whale, I think, at that age already.
Good.
But when I realized what I was watching in this big movie theater, they could not drag me out of there.
Did they try?
Just briefly. And
okay.
I said, no, we're staying. I have to see this. This is amazing.
Stick your guns.
And we sat there, and that changed my life.
How were Mom and Grandma?
I think they loved it.
Okay, good. I was on my 11th birthday, and it's funny how we remember specific things. So December 19th, 1981. No, it was my 12th. It was my 12th birthday, 1981. I know this because it was on a Friday, and it was the opening day for the Burt Reynolds movie Sharky's Machine.
Oh, yeah.
I was a Burt Reynolds fan as a kid. I was a straight white male, is what happens. But but my father took me, and he knew I wanted to go. He brought my grandmother, who counted the curse words. Not during... thing. Yeah, wasn't doing this, but still that was, and you know, you want to be respectful to your grandmother, and you know, you don't want to turn and look and go, that's all you got out of it? So you can't do that. So anyway, that's fine.
Yeah.
Good call on Young Frankenstein. That's great. I saw it in a drive, I think it was at the drive-in with The Towering Inferno.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Inferno went first.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, I just remember the girl falling. That was scary as hell. But and then as time goes on, when you find out that Mel Brooks got the original set from Universal for 20th Century Fox to do that, and it looks great.
Oh, yeah.
Still does.
Yep.
So yeah, we're very excited for. But anyway, it's all a timing thing. So once again, tell people where to go for tickets, and it runs through the end of March.
Sure. IndieFringe.org, IndieDistrictTheater.org, or the Laugh Shows, LAFF Shows, Facebook page. And hold on to your butts, Jurassic Park parody, and Done with Love. I mean, obviously, I love the film, and everybody involved with the show loves the movie, so it's very much a love letter as well as a hysterical parody.
Did you watch it before preparing to rehearse?
I did not.
Really? You knew it that well?
I do, yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
I know it.
I've watched it with my kids.
How are your kids on it?
Oh, they're crazy about it.
Okay.
Yeah, they're as big a cinephiles as I am.
Have you had, and how old are your kids?
My daughter's 15. Oh.
No, it's not 15. It's 15. Emma doesn't really do that, but she makes fun of people. Anyway, sorry, 15.
And my son is 11 and a half.
Oh, well, he's right in the wheelhouse for
this.
All right, what was the first film you tried to show them that is a love of yours and it didn't jive well?
Duck Soup.
No.
Yeah, it was too young because they've since come around to it.
Oh,
they're now huge Marx Brothers fans.
Welcome to old dad's talking.
But it was I was so excited,
and it didn't have the same.
No.
okay, but yes, because Emma went through, Emma's 17, my kid, and they, yeah, there was a phase of film that we call it the first wave. Mm-hmm. She either doesn't remember, and I have to tell her, like, yeah, we were here, we watched it, and obviously it had that much of an effect. So
yeah, I'm really fortunate with my kids' taste.
They still watch. Well, and have, what is something that they've introduced you to?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I would have voluntarily gone to see the Lego Movie.
Oh, okay.
If they had not brought me to it. And it's a great film.
Yes, it is.
It's a really good
movie.
I
think you and I, and I showed it to Emma, was reluctant, and because it looked like a commercial. It looks like a 90-minute commercial, but it is much smarter than that.
Oh, yeah.
And actually tells a story as far as, well, when we've all done this, of what to do with your Legos, how to play with your Legos, and it's also a symbolism for imagination.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, it was
much
smarter.
I mean, I was in tears at the end. It was beautiful. It was really well done.
I'm still talking her, and but she's 17 and stubborn, but about the Lego Batman movie. Mm-hmm. And, of course, next week, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse comes out on DVD and Blu-ray, which Lynn and Emma saw and loved. So, let's see. The first here's one. First film you took the kids to in a theater.
That, well, Sophia would have been first.
Right.
And
good training.
I think her first movie was, oh, gosh. I'm sure it was a Disney film.
Yeah. I don't think you're going to hit her with the hard, dark stuff first.
There was some pretty dark stuff
early
on.
Like, I'll give you time to think.
Okay.
Because Emma's first was Racing Stripes. She was four. So the zebra wanted to be a racehorse movie. And she was on, sitting on the seat. About halfway through, wondered if it was over. But still kind of got through it. And then went through major animation phase. That was all she wanted to watch.
Uh-huh.
I had to review Zathura. And that was the first live-action one. We also got there late. They had the screening in Greenwood. So we were in the back row of the front section. And that got a little arm-grabby because of the aliens and being in space. So, but yeah, there was that evolution.
I think I know what it was.
Okay.
So, I hope this counts, but I think it was she would consider it an early cinematic experience. So I used to be the executive director of Muncie Civic Theater.
Yes.
And I had that position when she was born and as she was in her early years. And I, as part of my stewardship of the place, I had a film series. I had do you remember that?
Yeah.
So I would show films in a theme on
course.
A Saturday. Like,
of course.
A three or four film package on a Saturday, usually by director or by genre or something like that. One of the weekends, we just did The Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
On the big screen at the Civic Theater. And she was there for that.
Cool.
I think she was probably three.
And she handled it well?
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, loved
good.
It.
Yeah, I have a couple of regular guests on the show, Brian and Monica Hartz.
Oh, yeah.
They took Beatrice. They took her to see Wizard of Oz in the theater, and it was her first time with the movie, which I thought was very impressive.
Yeah,
they had not buckled and watched it, Thanksgiving? Because when I think of Thanksgiving dinner, I think of Wizard of Oz. But that's another gripe for another time. How about your son?
I think that his first film, let me think. So that was 2007. So, you're stumping me on this.
It's not the dating game.
I know it.
It's a newlywed game. But
yeah. Again,
what
I'm
do you mean
sure
you don't remember?
Something
right. Okay.
Disney.
But you also, so the fact that you also have the conflict between girl films and boy films.
They're both complete
really?
Comic-Con nerds.
Okay,
they're both
good.
Like
good.
Full-on embracing the nerdness.
All right.
We go to all the pop-cons and Comic-Cons and this cons and that cons and full cosplay and manga and anime
all right.
and all of it.
All right, so good. You dodged that bullet. Have you introduced them to Mystery Science Theater?
Oh, we've watched all of the previous series.
Okay.
We're on the second episode of the new season
of the Gauntlet.
New, yes.
Oh yeah. So you watch I Emma in her younger days would refer to it as Daddy Movies with the Funny Robots, and then I think after I inflicted, as recorded constantly on the show, after I inflicted Manos, the Hands of Fate, on Emma, and Mary Jo Field referred to me as a terrible father, Emma had to be selective about, she hasn't watched a full film in a while, but if it's a great short film, Specialty Bread is one that is a favorite of ours, and I knew I had done something well when she introduced that short film to her best friend. But I have talked about the fact that I said, Emma, I know I throw a lot of titles at you that you got to watch. You got to watch Mac and Me.
That
Mac
was the last one that we watched.
Destroyed it's by Mystery Science Theater, and which is a bad film in and of itself. And there's a few moments like Manos, it has to be seen to be believed, McDonald's. And of course, Paul Rudd is added to that mystique with that film.
Yes.
It's just, so anyway, I'm glad you guys are still as a trio with Mr. Science Theater there.
Yes.
All right. Shifting gears a little bit. So we, and I apologize for not being on the show, having the show last week. Work got in the way, but that's not your problem. That's mine. But opening in theaters this weekend is the latest film from Michael Winterbottom called The Wedding Guest. And this stars Deb Patel, pardon my Indian, Radhika Apte, and Jim Sarba. And it's a thriller that's also a mixture of modern noir. He's a man that we see with ominous music playing throughout, going from London to Pakistan, and he is assigned to kidnap a woman from a family. As we find out, she is about ready to get married. She does not want to get married to this family, so she wants to get back with her original lover, who has funded this assignment, but he's not coming up with the money, and he's starting to get cold feet. So and really about an hour in, there's a twist where she goes from being damsel in distress to not quite a partner, but if you know enough film noir, you learn you're not really not sure who to trust this case. So there's really good tension on this. It's a fairly short film, so it doesn't drag out. And also the fact that it's set in, and we go from Pakistan to the Punjab district to India. So we also you also have the government and the authorities and all the other aspects in film noir thrown in with countries that we don't always see film noir in, because we're Americans. But so anyway, it's a cool twist on a familiar genre with a modern telling. So that is out in theaters now. Now, depending on when you listen to the show, if it is still not in theaters, you should check it out when it comes out on Blu-ray and DVD. But there's a film called Reuben Brandt Collector. It's an animated film in which, and there sometimes you watch an animated film and you think, well, could they have made this live action? And that is not the case in this. It's an art heist film. A series of famous paintings are being picked off one by one. We have a psychotherapist who has nightmares. One of his patients is one of the people involved in this. So there is a little tangled web of how these two parties are together, linked to the series of robberies. But it's animated in a style like the paintings that are represented in the film. And I wish I could remember. A few years ago, there was an animated short film that I loved, and I'm sorry for not doing the research on this, but it was like a big city car chase movie, but it's all corporate logos. I'll have to look that up and get back to you on that. But it has that feel. So you see, so you can enjoy it in and of itself. It is a visual feast. It might be overwhelming as far as the visuals. It's kind of a fun, like, you know, if you're a fan of the Ocean's films, if you're a fan of your ensemble heist films, there's that. But then the more you know about art, like Warhol, Lichtenstein, Picasso, Miro, you're going to get a little more out of it. But nice. It is a fun visual feast. So look out for Reuben Brandt Collector. New on DVD and Blu-ray from last week, because I snarkingly wrote about it on social media, last week's big title was Creed 2. I saw Rocky in the theater when I was six. That's another huge impact film. We had in my hometown of Flint, Michigan, we had the Dort. I remember it, on Dort Highway, the Flint Cinema. It was our big single screen. So Rocky, Death on the Nile, Reds. I remember seeing Reds there. Oh, the first Raiders of the Lost Ark. Uh-huh. I mean, that's big screen. So, yes. So now we have evolved. And I was a big fan of the first Creed. I really thought the retelling of Adonis Creed and the mixture of old and new was very smart. Kind of in even in a as the level of a Bond film.
And Michael B. Jordan's great.
Yeah, and he's a great actor. Always solid. Always solid. And well. This time around, I think because of the success of Creed, because they throw elements of Rocky 2 and 3 and 4 because Drago comes back.
Oh, yeah.
And as I stated, Creed 2 has more dad issues than Hamlet and King Lear combined because Adonis is still dealing with his dad. Rocky apparently is not the greatest dad in the world. Dolph Lundgren shows. Nice to see Dolph in this. Dolph actually says more in this than he did in Rocky IV. And of course, he's disgraced in his homeland, so he's now overtraining his son for this bout. Brigitte Nielsen has nothing to say in this film, literally, so she's back in there. Apollo's trainer's son is involved in this film, and I should say shout out to Flint actor Tony Burton, who played Apollo's original trainer. He was also the guy who played chess. You know, you saw him play chess in Rocky IV. He also had a fun role in The Shining, and according to legend, he beat Stanley Kubrick real life in chess.
Wow.
So, smart dude, Tony Burton. So anyway, yeah, and it's a different director because the director of Creed decided to do something a little more challenging, like Black Panther.
Right.
So the fight sequences aren't the same. Mm-hmm. So the combination of that and there's somebody's pregnant, and then so there, anyway, there's and marriage and houses and so anyway, it just feels like a mishmash of let's take these sequel aspects and throw them in here. Is Clubber Lang Jr. going to show up in the next film? I honestly don't know. They could. They really could. Mr. T's available. So they really could go down that path. I honestly just hope they don't. So anyway, that is out. And, of course, The Favorite, which if I was voting would have been my Best Picture winner.
Great film.
Yep, and that is so. And The Onion, or I should say The AV Club, did a during Oscar week, they had, well, if you like this film, then you should check out this film. And when they did The Favorite, they picked Ken Russell's Listomania.
Bat-spit crazy.
Did you see it?
Oh, yeah.
Roger Daltrey as Franz Liszt. And I think the ad campaign was, it out Tommy's Tommy. Because if you thought Tommy was bat-spit crazy, Listomania's worse, better, more.
Listomania's almost unwatchable.
Now there's a list. Let me guess, you have not inflicted that on the kids yet?
I have not.
No.
But I might at some point. Just, you know.
That's not a bad list to go. What is almost unwatchable but still watchable? And you know, folks, I think we all have those. I have a lot of them.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, that came out last week. This week, the big title, of course, is Green Book. It still won Best Picture. As I talked with my buddy Chris Lloyd online, I know there's a big backlash against this film. I liked it. I didn't love it. I just don't think it's Best Picture material.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the best film about race that came out last year. I think if you've never seen a film about race relations, then Green Book is right up your alley. But you know, the IFJA, we named The Hate U Give as the best film of the year as a group, and that's a far more challenging film about race relations.
Absolutely. It's problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless, I mean, it's a finely crafted movie, but it's problematic.
There was a combination of things that were you expect to happen at the Oscars, like people kind of getting a career achievement award, but I still like Black Klansman, yeah. and some folks getting their, you know, they kind of nailed it right. And even if you were wrong, like, you know, I thought, like many, I thought Glenn Close was going to win, but I was really excited for Olivia Colman.
Sure.
You know, and I knew it was a long, long, long shot for Paul Schrader. First Reformed was my favorite film of last year.
Yeah.
And but to end the evening with Green Book, and because it also got Best Original Screenplay. Let's not get into that.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's out there. If you think it's the best film of the year, email me, send me a note. I'd like to hear from you. I really would. So and Chris and I have already talked. It's fine. Also out on DVD and Blu-ray, did we need these? Did we need another Fantastic Beasts? They're still immigrants, right? We're doing the Wizards Are Immigrants thing still. They're build a wall, let the wizards fill it. Yeah, okay.
Well, Johnny Depp needed a
paycheck. He's got an island. Well, he had more than an island to maintain, but there's other things going on there. And then I don't know anybody who saw Mortal Engines.
I did not see Mortal Engines.
See?
I was kind of a little jazzed about the trailer when the teaser trailer, when it was really short and seemed like really innovative and cool, and then the longer trailer, I was like, oh.
I think I'm a little burnt out on dystopian stuff.
Yeah.
A little bit. Okay, so with that in mind, shifting gears a little bit, at IU Cinema, again, we're Mark and – this will run. So Monday at 7 o'clock, I think I remember seeing this on my first incarnation of cable. From 1978, The Marriage of Maria Braun at 7 o'clock on Monday, March 18th. This was up in Michigan. We had something called Channel 100. And I believe they did not care when they ran R-rated movies. They just kind of ran them whenever. But mostly in the late afternoon, early. But I think I've seen this film, so... Thursday, March 21st at 7 o'clock, Capernaum. Of course, that was one of the best foreign language films. That's also running on Friday, March 22nd. Not a double feature, so you have to pay twice, but it's really okay. Saturday, March 23rd at 4 o'clock, the best film to have 50 hard-boiled eggs, Cool Hand Luke. Got to get Mrs. Sosie to wash the car. and Strother Martin. People who don't know Strother Martin still quote Strother Martin because of this. So yes. What we have here is a failure to communicate. Japan at 7 o'clock on Saturday the 23rd. Sunday the 24th, Miss Hakase at 1 o'clock and Fly Me to the Moon at 4 o'clock. Monday, March 25th, Silent Light at 7 p.m. Thursday, March 28th, Our Time at 7 p.m. Friday, March 29th, Carlos Regattas at 7 p.m. And, I'm now reading screens. That's what you do here at Film Sociology. This Jorgensen guest filmmaker program will be in the form of an extended onstage interview. Battle in Heaven at 11 o'clock. Saturday, March 30th, Light After Darkness at 4 p.m. And In the Life of Music and Rapture at 7 p.m. at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin.
Yay, I love the Art Craft.
15th, 16th, and 17th at 2 and 7:30 p.m. on the 15th and 16th, 2 p.m. on the 17th. Yes, as mentioned earlier, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
That'll be great to see.
See
it
on a big screen.
Absolutely.
See it on a big screen if you can, please. Also coming up, and the screen's not moving. Friday and Saturday, March 22nd and 23rd, and Sunday at 2 p.m., Galaxy Quest.
Somewhat of a deep dive.
That's another good one to see. And that was one that really, I mean, it did okay in theaters and got a huge life on home video. So now's another chance to see this. And I always say if you watch and like Galaxy Quest, watch one, if not both of the documentaries, Trekkies.
Yes, absolutely.
So, March 29th and 30th, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., Field of Dreams. And then... wow. Thursday, April 4th at 7:30 p.m., the documentary Hitchcock Truffaut.
Oh, wow.
That will be cool. So that's the two gentlemen talking about their work. So the greatest story Hitchcock ever told. So anyway, that is at the Historic Art Craft Theater. Now, catching up on some films that have been sent to me through various companies. Let me ask you, sir, how were you on Whiplash?
I liked Whiplash.
As did I.
I was a fan of Whiplash.
Black Swan.
Oh yeah, I loved Black Swan.
All right. See, there's a good test. my daughter loves both of those. My daughter made a boy watch those films back to back.
Wow.
Yeah. He's not around anymore.
No,
he didn't quite pass the test.
That's
okay. But if you like those, and I mean like in a cinematic way, because really, I mean, but there's a documentary called Over the Limit, and it's about a Russian rhythmic gymnast, and basically what she goes through with a very miserable coach getting her through. And she's also getting close to retirement age, 20. So, but there's the moment of right before she goes on, she's trying to qualify for her final Olympics, and right before she goes on stage, she says to herself, looking up, "God help me."
Oh.
And it seemed not like a good luck, but more like a cry for help.
Yes.
And as the film goes on, yeah, it shows. So it shows the ins and outs of gymnastics, and in a way, it was Black Swan kind of tackles this. This doesn't have the psychological mom issues. It's still a psychological warfare between a girl who is just near the end of her athletic career in this aspect and just a miserable human being coaching her. Mm. So if you're up for a challenge like that, that is out there. Also with it was a short film called Iron Hands, which was about a 12-year-old girl trying out for the Chinese weightlifting team. And you have the pudgy, used-to-be athlete who works the gym who winds up taking her under her wing until the final, minute so of the film and helps her out. So anyway, that is, if you're into that, Over the Limit through Film Movement. Also in the classic section from 1997, the French film Margis, pardon my French, but this was a film Sophie Marceau did 2 years after Braveheart. So she had just gotten introduced in the States. She's a street dancer who finds herself in gaining fame as an actress in 17th century France. Street dancer who did other side jobs with her dad as her boss.
Oh. Lovely.
So many jokes and not in jokes. We're just going to move on. But as she works her way up the ladder, both ways, and also there's the backstage shenanigans, and anybody who does theater, we, of course, like watching backstage shenanigans so long as they don't involve us. So
and a period piece.
And it is it's a gorgeous-looking film. It is an expensive-looking. I don't know whose castle they conned into shooting on weekends and days off, but it looks great. I believe shot
you
in France
and
Italy.
You rarely get to see sort of a backstage look at that era,
right.
In the theater.
It's expensive.
Yeah.
Costumes are not cheap. Yeah. And I'll give an example of she gets noticed when the king comes to see her perform, and she is supposed to do, the other part is she keeps wanting to get lines, but her, including Molière. Molière has a presence in this film. She keeps not getting lines. She keeps getting known for her dancing, and there's the one time she forgets to put on her pantaloons before doing a cartwheel.
Oh.
And if you're a Sophie Marceau fan, they film it differently. So get over it. So there's that. So anyway, it is stories we've seen before. It just looks like a gorgeous costume piece, and it's a little bawdy. So that is out there called Margis from 1997. There are films, and I know you've probably gone through this as I have, where you see something and it reminds you of something, so you watch that and it reminds you of something. So here is my... Here was my trifecta from earlier this week. And by the way, folks, I'm okay. But also from Film Movement is an exploitation film from Argentina called She-Wolf.
Oh.
And it is shot in black and white. It looks really good. And we have a woman who, there's basically a serial killer going through Buenos Aires. It is just young women's. And sometimes she is in the form of a prostitute and in the form of a girl with her hair all tied up, looking younger, and then herself. And so we're like, you're asked early on, is it three women or is it her in three different variations in her own mind? It's kind of that. So, and there's a lot of intimate scenes, and there's a reason why this, well, if it gets remade in the States, it'll get neutered completely. It's shot enough that...
Neutered, is that a wolf
sure.
joke?
No, that too. Spade this... No, but the intimate scenes are shot at certain angles, so it's not... I mean, it would still get an NC-17 here in the United States, but it's not enough that you can label it porn. Yeah, erotica film, I guess, is kind of a way of putting it. So... Anyway, so it's again short and to the point, and it looks, the black and white photography is cool, but it is still an exploitation film, and it does its job. It does its job of just enticing and you can't spell that, so I don't know. But because of that, It reminded me of an Abel Ferrara film from the 90s called The Addiction, with Annabella Sciorra, Lily Taylor, Christopher Walken. She is a grad student who is Lily Taylor's a grad student in New York who's bitten by Annabella Sciorra. And there's, because it's Abel Ferrara, because this is the man who gave us Bad Lieutenant and King of New York and Body Snatchers, it's vampires symbolic of drug addiction and sex, and she's a philosophy major, if I remember correctly. And one of her best friends, this is 1995, 96, Edie Falco is in this.
Oh, yeah.
And he throws a lot at you because Abel does that. Yeah. But there's still a little bit of bloodletting. And Christopher Walken shows up in one scene and does Walken-like things because he's friends with Abel Ferrara or owes him a favor for King of New York.
Is he a vampire in the film?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course he is. So Lily Taylor knows nothing about being a vampire. Chris has to explain it to her. So, but it also has gorgeous black and white cinematography. So it reminded me of that. And then I have piles of movies at my house. These are first world problems. And speaking of Abel Ferrara, I had found it, had never seen it, one of his early films from 1979, an exploitation film called Driller Killer.
Driller Killer.
This is before Ms. 45, which was kind of the first thing he was known for, a female death wish, only darker, cheaper, and grungier. This one, Ferrara himself, under a pseudonym, plays a starving artist who's the pressure of work and living in New York and trying to maintain. Finally, he finally snaps and becomes the title of the film. It's short, and you wish he had maybe spent a little money on another actor to play the lead, but it does provide what the film, you know, it's kind of those, you expect a film like that, you expect it to deliver what it says, and it does that. It's not for everybody,
right?
And it's not really symbolic of, well, it can be, but I would say the killing is not I don't think it's symbolic of sex, and I'm sure Abel Ferrara would tell me otherwise, but I didn't see it that way. And it also captures sections of New York that no regular filmmaker would probably dare shoot in 1978-79. So anyway, I can say I saw it. He gets a little more philosophical in Ms. 45, and then we get to his heyday of King of New York, Bad Lieutenant, and The Addiction. So anyway, that is out there. Occasionally we go into the archives. I like going to films, buying or renting films that are available online only, or you can only buy them online, like Warner Archives. And
sure.
And I'm a big fan of the 70s blaxploitation film, or as Fred Williamson said, who's getting exploited? My check's cleared. We go to, and what's interesting about the blaxploitation films is occasionally you will get you'll get a urban version of an already said told story. For instance, Bernie Casey's film Hitman, some would say, is a ghetto version of Get Carter. Cool Breeze was an African American version of The Asphalt Jungle. And we know what Blackula was, we know what Blackenstein was, we know what Dr. Black and Mr. Hyde were. There's a film called Melinda from 1972, and it has elements of Laura and some other 40s kind of film noir stories. The star of this is Calvin Lockhart, famed that guy, probably best known as Biggie Smalls in Let's Do It Again.
Yep.
Yes, of the second of those. He plays a DJ. You know, it's always fun to watch DJs represented in cinema. Not nearly as smooth. This guy could have been Venus Flytrap's older brother. A nice, Los Angeles cocksure DJ who picks up a woman, title of the movie, and winds up dead in his apartment. And so after a whirlwind romance and very short montage, he goes to work and comes back to his apartment to find it trashed and her killed. And, of course, he's the prime suspect. So then it's finding out who set him up. And, of course, you know, you have an ex involved, and you have figuring out who's a friend of his that may have betrayed him. The cops are hassling him because it's the 70s. And then the setup and trying to figure all that out. Rosalind Cash is in this. Vanetta McGee is the title role. The other part, which is the other novelty aspect for me, this was the first film featuring Jim Kelly of Black Belt Jones and Enter the Dragon fame.
Oh.
He plays guess what? He runs a karate studio. and is a friend of Calvin Lockhart's, who shows up near the end of the film in a sequence. If you ever saw the ninja attack in the film The Killer Elite, the Sam Peckinpah film, it's mm-hmm. right up there. It's really ridiculous but fun. So anyway, that's a fun couple hours with the film Melinda. Now we got to get to, as Chris Lloyd said, dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And this was one of those. There was a lot of people online saying, I thought he was already dead. And it's also a cautionary tale, but actor Jan Michael Vincent.
Oh, yeah.
At one time, here was a guy who was kind of a child actor in the 60s. I know for a lot of people, he first got in the people's minds with the series Danger Island as a part of the Banana Splits. And then, of course, did films like The World's Greatest Athlete and the original Mechanic. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, Charles Bronson did some decent action film in the 70s.
Oh, sure.
And there's actually a really good twist, actually a really good double twist at the end of The Mechanic. With him, Jan Michael Vincent is a young assassin working under the wing of Charles Bronson. So anyway, that's from 1972. Then he had a pretty good streak where he was a handsome, good-looking guy who was starting to get some starring roles. He worked with Gene Hackman in Bite the Bullet. Mm-hmm. Then there was White Line Fever, Baby Blue Marine, Shadow of the Hawk, Vigilante Force, Damnation Alley. Oh, find that, folks. That's... Well, technology has come a long way since 1977, and that, you know, any futuristic film in the 70s where, you know, if it's not Logan's Run where they look like they're in white disco football uniforms,
yes.
Yeah, that's kind of like that. Big Wednesday, which is still a film I really, really like, a surfer film with Gary Busey, William Catt, and Jan mm-hmm. Michael Vincent. Of course, played another prodigy is a stuntman Ski and Hooper with Burt Reynolds.
Yes.
Underrated Burt Reynolds film directed by Hal Needham.
Great homage. Director and stunt master. My goodness.
And gotten a career achievement Oscar. Good for him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I still need to pick up his autobiography, which is a fun read. Again, they're not all home runs. We know Megaforce and the stuff he did after Smokey and the Band and Cannonball Run. Let's see. He also did Michael Vincent also starred in Defiance, The Return, Hard Country, was one of the major players in The Winds of War, and then did Airwolf, and then got a second career in television. Really, the last thing he did that I saw, because he played, I believe, a police officer in Cheech Marin's comedy Born in East L.A. in 1987. But he kept working, and he, of course, had life issues that derailed his career. By the 90s, I went through his IMDb page, as you can hear here on the show, but appeared in a lot of films that looked like they were probably made straight to video with really generic titles. Here we go. These are in a row. Beyond the Call of Duty, Midnight Witness, Sins of Desire, Hidden Obsession, Deadly Heroes, Indecent Behavior.
Hey, he was working.
He was working. Right. That's it. That's on the other side. He's working. So there was that. Yeah. He also appeared in Ice Cream Man, and yes, in 2000, worked with Dan Haggerty on Escape to Grizzly Mountain. I didn't know how many Grizzly Mountains there were. So anyway, sad stuff. But so a good reason to go back and check out something like Big Wednesday or Hooper or something like
Hooper.
That.
Hooper. That's my recommendation.
Yeah. It's a fun, again, it kind of gets overshadowed by Smokey and Cannonball, and it shows stuntmen as really vulnerable. And, you know, for Reynolds at that time to do anything vulnerable of any kind. And I know that the Brian Keith, what I remember was Brian Keith, who plays the father of Sally Field, plays Jock Mahoney, which, of course, Sally Field's real-life father.
Right.
So Bert is supposed to be Hal Needham. And Jan Michael Vincent is supposed to be the late, great Dar Robinson, who did ridiculous stunts, worked with Reynolds on Hustle, Sharky's Machine, had a great stunt at the end of that, and had a great stunt at the end of Burt Reynolds' Stick. Mm. And then, tragically, did a simple motorcycle jump that killed him. So, wow, on that note. I guess, once again, give us the dates and the times for Hold On To Your Butts. And, folks, you have plenty of titles to look for based on the paper I'm wielding in front of you.
Absolutely.
On the radio.
Hold On To Your Butts is a parody of Jurassic Park, and it plays at the District Theater Friday and Saturday nights at 8 o'clock and 10 o'clock through March the 30th, followed up by The Golden Girls, The Lost Episodes, which plays those same evenings in April, and Fly, You Fools, a parody of The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, which plays those same days and times in the month of May. Tickets are at IndieFringe.org, IndieDistrictTheater.org, or at the Laugh Shows Facebook page. That's L-A-F-F Shows, stands for Loud and Fast Funny Shows.
Darren, thanks for hanging out.
Thanks, Matthew.
Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by. Soylent Green is people, Zardoz is spoken. Go see a good movie. There's plenty out there, and go see some funny stage stuff. You deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD2 The Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
Soylent Green is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!